Welcome to Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole.
Hi, I'm Brandon Mole. I'm a number one New York Times bestselling author of a bunch of fantasy series like the Fablehaven series and many more.
And I'm Jason Conforto. I'm a filmmaker, a podcaster, and game designer. In this podcast, we're excited to share our love for story and our passion to create.
We hope to share a bunch of experiences and lessons learned over a lifetime in creative fields.
All right. She's kind of a big deal, and she's back. Shannon, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I didn't know who you meant. I just saw the cat walk in, so I thought you were talking about the cat.
No, I'm talking about you. I was actually being a little tongue-in-cheek because my wife and I last night went on a hike, an overnighting backpacking trip,
wow.
And we were listening to Kind of a Big Deal as we were watching.
That's a book I wrote.
Yeah, it is a book you wrote. I'm surprised you didn't get the reference.
Well, I think you're one of three people who read it, so
yeah.
You're part of a very elite club.
A very elite club. And I enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
No, it was very good.
It came out in 2020, and it was one of those things that was like, oh, did that happen?
Yep,
I'm not sure if they actually did publish.
That is funny.
They did publish it. So today we're talking about the fantasy genre, why you guys write in that genre, what do you guys love about it, and kind of what brought you into fantasy. So Shannon, tell us a little bit about why you chose fantasy for your career.
I started reading fantasy about third grade. In fourth grade, I got the book fair order, the complete set of the Chronicles of Narnia. And then in my school library, it was Joan Aiken, Lloyd Alexander, Patricia McKillop, Anne McCaffrey, Robin McKinley. Like, my favorites just were all fantasy, fantasy, fantasy. So I took it all very seriously. And once you start in high school, they stop teaching any genre. Everything is realistic fiction, mm-hmm. preferably tragic.
Right.
And usually written 50 years ago or more. There's no more comedy. There's no adventure. There's no mystery. There's no romance. Certainly not a sci-fi fantasy, unless it's the Odyssey. And in my mind, I translated that to mean you outgrow genre.
Mm-hmm.
A serious writer, reader, adult eschews those things. And I wanted to start being, I don't know, I wanted to be a writer so bad, I felt like I had to read what was good for me. And I literally started to choose my books. I had the Cliff Notes.
Mm-hmm.
They had a list in the back of all the books they do Cliff Notes for. And I thought, that must be a list of the best books. So I started reading from the A's and checking them off as I went.
Yeah, like eating your vegetables.
Vegetables. And of course, there was much that was great about it. Yeah. But I didn't realize that I'd really gotten into a reading depression until I was in college. And we went with a friend to a little independent bookstore. And he was running his hands across the spines of the books and smelling them. And he said, oh, don't you just love books? And part of me went, no. And I was so shocked by that. That's not who I am. Of course I love books. But I realized I didn't. It had become a chore.
Yeah, homework.
It had become homework to me. And that was so tragic to me.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I have fallen out of love with reading.
And it's because all she was reading was the Cliff Notes.
Oh, is that the problem?
She's like, oh, it goes beyond summaries?
Why does everybody write in summary nowadays?
It's not a lot of genre. Detail.
Obviously, I'm joking.
But I did do that once. I remember doing a book report in ninth grade on Anna Karenina. And I remember my book report said, it was kind of boring. I guess the train scene was okay, but the rest of it was really dull. I don't really feel like I knew the characters. And then in page count, it was like 140 pages. And my teacher was like, no.
You did not read it.
And it turned out my mom had, you know, it was on our bookshelf at home and it was an abridged version, which is a thing they used to do.
Yeah.
And I was like, no wonder I hated it. It was so boring.
The Reader's Digest can
be a book. That's what it was. I didn't know. Anyway, so when I was at grad school, I came home for Christmas break and my brother was not a reader and I wanted to get him reading on something. So I pulled out a set of books that I had loved when I was younger, and it was Lloyd Alexander's The Chronicles of Prydain series, which is a fantasy series. And to get him excited about it, I read him some or all of the first book, The Book of Three. And he got into it, and he read the whole series, but I got into it. And so I'm home on Christmas break, and I reread the whole Chronicles of Prydain series. And I remembered, like, oh, I still love this. This is great. So I started rereading old fantasy, and it turned out that some of the fantasy books that I used to love, I didn't love anymore. like my sensibilities of like what makes a good sentence had been raised, and I couldn't fall into the story in the same way because I was editing it. But other ones I could. So my goal with the when I wrote The Goose Girl was, can I bring back the wonder and feeling of what reading meant to me when I was 10 and 12 and 14 and loving and falling in love with a book? But can I bring with it the, you know, the literary sensibilities that I have developed and write at the sentence level and thematically and everything, something really solid? So that was my, that's how, and then it was a dare with a friend. So that's how I got back into fantasy out of being
You just dropped in that dare with a friend there.
Well, I talked about it in the last episode.
I dare you to write a fantasy novel.
I'll show you. I'll do it.
Double dog dare you. You know what? I'm going to take the next 6 months.
That's kind of what happened.
Brandon, I know you've mentioned Narnia as well as kind of your launching point, but what other things inspired you when you were growing up?
Yeah, you know, it was, yeah, I mean, Narnia was my gateway to literacy on top of being my gateway to fantasy. It was the first time I read a book and went, oh, there's other really good imaginations in the world besides mine, because I just liked living in my head. I hadn't learned that reading was a way to live in other people's heads and that other people had thoughts worth sharing, you know? And after I read Narnia, I was like, oh my gosh, wait a minute. And so, yeah, I just started exploring, and I'm just a sucker for changing reality. Like, I was the kind of kid who got bored very easily, and I was almost always bored in class, and I kind of hated school. And I never wanted things to be the way they were. I wanted them to be better than they were. And fantasy seemed like a cheat code that suddenly was making everything a little better than it was. It was a little grander, a little more interesting, a little more scary. For me, that just had the special sauce. And it still kind of does. Like some of my very favorites, it's still fantasy. Like, my favorite novel still is Lord of the Rings. You know, if I had to pick one, that's my favorite. Right. That's just has the most things I like in it. But I really strongly think that if you want to be good at writing fantasy, it's so healthy to read some really good stuff outside of fantasy. So you can bring some of those sensibilities into fantasy, kind of like Shannon was describing. That is, you're only going to benefit by being good at your craft, right? And there are so many talented writers writing in so many different genres. But I do remember that in college, when I was studying writing at BYU, and I have an illustrious English minor, you know, to go with my comms major, PR major, thinking, okay, a PR job will pay the bills, right? But secretly wanting to be a writer desperately, you know. And so as part of that English minor, like, all the training I got from creative writing teachers was just like what Shannon described, where there wasn't an emphasis on genre at all. And to me, I kind of was like, this is a little disappointing, but also maybe it's an opportunity, because maybe the only people that write genre are just people that just happen to love it and write genre. Like there's no one training anyone to do it. Like, you just have to be really into it and go do it. And talking to my creative writing professor, he said more or less, that's true. You know, he's like, yeah, if you want to be a writer, just get good at writing the kind of stuff you want to write and see what happens. You know, he's like, that's it. You don't need any sort of advanced degrees. And he said, if you want to teach writing, go get advanced degrees. But, right. You know, and he's like, or if you want it for your own training, if it feels like it's helping you, you know, get your advanced degrees. But there's no prerequisite, right? And he kind of was like, if fantasy is what you love, that's hard to go get trained in that. He's like, just do it.
That's interesting. I like how you, Shannon, you mentioned there was a period of time where they took fantasy away. They took those genres away, and all you were taught was the boring books, right? And I think what we're seeing now is a generation of kids who are now adults, you know, the children of the 80s, who are like, hey, that magic time in the 80s was awesome. And I just want it back. And I think that created a hole for you two to fill with fantasy genre books and you and others, right? Like, that are doing that. But I think before that, there wasn't a lot of space for adults to continue to be kids. Like, I look back at my parents, especially my dad. He wasn't a kid when I was a kid, right? Like, he was a full-on adult. Me, at his age now, like I'm still playing Dungeons and Dragons with my friends. Like he wasn't doing that. I'm still watching nerdy shows and cartoons with my kids and doing that kind of stuff.
Right.
And, and so I think this generation wants this. We wanted to take what was in our childhood and just keep going with it.
I don't know what was happening specifically with fantasy publishing, but I know, for example, to your point, in comics publishing, it was they were the funny books, right? And like kids would use their allowance and buy comic books from the spinner rack in the 7-Eleven. And then we got into starting in the 80s, in the 80s and the 90s, comics entered this era that was so serious. And kids couldn't buy them anymore because of the price differences and stuff. At the convenience store, you had to go to the comic book shop. And, you know, The Dark Knight and, you know, The Flash had a drug problem and, you know, it was murder. And, you know, it was like they were trying some great stuff written, but also they were trying really hard to say, we're not kids' stories. We're adult and we're serious.
Edgy.
Yes, yeah. It got very edgy and gritty. And very few publishers were publishing anything that was all ages, is what they used to call books books that were maybe about kids or, you know, that kids might enjoy. In fact, my husband was a lifelong comic reader, and in the early 2000s, after my first book came out in 2003 and 2004, we were like, why are there not comics for kids? And we actually went to DC and Marvel and pitched ideas, and they were not interested in doing books for young readers. So there was this idea for a long time that you had to grow up. And then I think, I don't know, maybe it's because Gen X never got to take over because the boomers are just outliving every other generation throughout time and they're not refusing to like turn power over to the next generation.
Stay kids.
The Gen X is like, okay, if that's what you're going to do, then we're going to go back to our childhood and we're going to have fun.
That could be.
Yeah.
That could be. Well, let's talk a little bit more about fantasy in general. What is it that draws you to write in that arena? Why aren't you writing these serious books? Why, not to say your books aren't serious, but why are you in the fantasy genre?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. For me, you got to write what you daydream about, what interests you. And for some reason, I love fantasy. It's what I daydream about. It's what interests me. It's like where my head goes when I make up stories, because a lot of my favorite books were fantasy. But there came a point where I was sort of like, you know, 30, 35, and I'm like, I'm writing stories about fairies. And I'm writing stories, you know, like my dad taught me how to play baseball and, you know, and I, in some ways I'm very much a grown up and why am I writing stories about centaurs and fairies? And I was like, you know, does this mean I'm ridiculous? And the more I thought about it, the more I was like, you know what? Like you can have these made up stories and still say true things. Still say things of import. And I would think about my favorite fantasy stories. And I think about Lord of the Rings. And I think about how Lord of the Rings had a young Frodo who was underpowered and was not a typical hero. And he saved the world by being really courageous and doing things that were incredibly scary to him and seemed impossible for him. And that book, for me, in my mind and in my heart, taught me more about heroism than I think I learned from any other source. And, you know, maybe the closest thing is my grandpa was a World War II pilot, and I had some conception of heroism from some of the stories I got from him. But in a kind of a more practical and intimate sense, Lord of the Rings showed me that, like, oh, yeah, you could be, just by facing something that's overwhelming, maybe that's what being a hero is, right? And it said it to me in a way that could reach me with my own tics and my own weird brain, right? And so I was like, well, maybe I could take fantasy and say something with it as well, where there's some truth or some substance inside of the make-believe.
What are some of those things that you try to relate within your books?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, it's just trying to have characters that feel honest and real and then putting them in tough circumstances and letting that kind of boil to the surface. Little true moments will hopefully come about. Where it gets a little more deliberate, an example would be my Beyonders series, because in my Beyonders series, part of the reason I wrote it was I looked around at the world And I saw that a lot of the people that were, that had kind of been taught and told were supposed to be my heroes, were sort of disappointments. And that was just a personal thing. And I don't want to name any names, but I'm just talking about almost like cheesy classic heroes, like sports players or mm-hmm. or political leaders or things like that, right? That like maybe in a sense that it, we don't even think that way as much anymore. But when I was a kid, I thought that way a little bit. And I kind of felt disappointed by a lot of the people who I thought were supposed to be role models or heroes. And I was like, how do you become a hero in a world where there's no heroes? Like where everyone that you think is a hero isn't and is like a sellout or is like a fraud or is disappointing you, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I don't have a way to speak to that that doesn't sound whiny and complaining and pointing fingers at people that, you know, are that I'm imperfect too. You know what I mean? I was like, but I could create a fantasy scenario where I could do it. And then I'm not naming names or pointing fingers, but I'm talking about an overall corrosive problem. And so one of my goals with Beyonders was just trying to create a story where, hey, we're in a world where basically all the heroes in one way or another are sellouts or failures. And how do you become a hero in a world like that? And how do you return to greatness for a hero that has become a sellout or a failure? And thematically, that was my whole goal with that whole series, right? I was kind of doing this massive thought experiment of what does it look like if you have a system that's taken down your heroes and people nonetheless try to become heroes, right? On top of that, I was just trying to tell a really fun story, right, but thematically, right. That was very deliberate. You know, like if you mapped the story through that lens, you would see a lot of broken heroes coming out of retirement, and you would see a kid who's kind of aimless, trying to figure out how much do I care about this world and how much do I want to go home? And like, am I willing to sacrifice for a place that I fell into through a hippo's mouth? You know, and that alone is fun to experiment. You know what I mean?
And I always like to point out with Beyonders is this was your first book, even though Fable Haven was published first.
Yeah.
Like this intention was there from the very beginning. Right. This was something that was part of what you were trying to do from the very start of your career is have a message. Right.
I was like, I don't want to die without saying this. Yes. That if you're swallowed by a hippo,
you too can become a hero.
A G.K. Chesterton is a fantasy writer, and he said that fantasy doesn't tell us that dragons exist. It tells us dragons can be defeated. Mm. And I love the heart of that. Saying like you're saying it, the broader story, the human story, it doesn't, the trappings of it don't have to be real, but the human story of it can be very real. He also said it's something like that these stories tell us that rivers run with wine to remind us for one wild moment that they run with water. And the idea that fantasy is tapping back into that early wonder with life that we kind of lose as we get older. Another thing he said was that a three-year-old is excited to read a book about that Tommy opened. No, I say a seven-year-old's excited to read a book that Tommy opened a door and saw a dragon. A three-year-old is excited to read a book that says Tommy opened a door. And so seeing a dragon on the other side of the door is reminding us of the wonder of doors open.
Yeah.
And there's something on the other side. You see that. I thought of that a lot when I had little kids, just the wonder of everything. And I think having little kids is kind of like having a fantasy, being in a fantasy story, because you're seeing the world through their eyes again when they discover everything for the first time. And I think that's what I love about fantasy, is it gives you that same thrill of, wow, look where we live. Look at life, look at the laws of physics. You throw something and it drops on the floor. Gravity, who knew? You know, the wonder of just being.
You've dropped a few things about your past a little bit, just picking up on. I'm trying to imagine a young version of you, a nerdy little girl going to the comic book store, grabbing stuff. Tell me, it's also we don't see a lot of girls in that the comic book store. It's kind of a seems to have this, and probably false to a degree, this like guy's world type thing. Have you felt that?
Like the comic book guy from the comic book,
it's a true stereotype, but I didn't go to comic book stores when I was a kid. That was very much it wasn't a choice I made. No one took me there. I didn't even know that was an option.
Because I noticed you're wearing deodorant, and that's...
My husband did. And so I got into comics later, and of course, it's full of fantasy. Mm-hmm. I mean, superhero stories are fantasy stories, or sci-fi, you might argue.
Right.
And I do think that there's that world is much more accessible to other people now, but in the past, it really wasn't. So I've written for DC and Marvel now, and sometimes when I do Comic-Con or things like that and I'm on a panel, I will be the only woman and it will be all men. Mm-hmm. So that hasn't been very open to a lot of people. And that is slowly changing, which I'm glad about. We wrote a couple novels about Marvel's Squirrel Girl. And yeah, yeah. What a great character. How fun. Last year we did a 3-page one-shot on Starfire. And we've done some books about Wonder Woman, young Wonder Woman. And so we realized we've written, I think, all three DC princesses. So we're like bringing the princess power back to DC. Yeah.
Well, tell me why we need more women in this space in general.
Yeah, when I was a kid, most of the fantasy writers were men, specifically mm-hmm. white men. And I really did cling to, you know, I read C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and Lloyd Alexander and stuff. But it was so thrilling for me to discover Robin McKinley. And not mm-hmm. only was there the woman was the lead, but she was a redhead. And I was like, what? Like, I never got to read redheads. I'm a redhead. And I think that's so true for so many kids of who are not, for whatever is predominant in their area, religion or race or economic background or anything, and never seeing themselves represented in a story. Mm-hmm. It really feels like you don't exist. You don't matter. If your story isn't worthy of a book or being a character in a comic book or whatever, then it's like saying you, the child, you, the reader, are not important enough for your own story. So the more you can see yourself in a book, the more possibilities are open to you. Women, but all different people. One thing that I think is really important, especially as writers, is to read books by people who are not like us demographically. Mm-hmm. This is a little bit tangent, but when I do writing workshops, this may shock you, so prepare yourself.
Yeah.
I've gotten bolder in my old age. And I will ask the men in the room who want to be professional writers and novelists, can you name 5 female authors that you've read more than one book by them? I've never had a man be able to say yes. And then I ask the women, can you name 20 male authors that you've read more than one book by? And they're like, obviously.
Yeah.
And I started asking that question because I noticed a lot of men I knew were really decent guys. And then their women, their female characters were so basic and stereotypical. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I know they know women in real life who are not like that. And yet the characters they're writing are like that. And I realized that we learn more about character writing by reading than we do by living. And so they were rewriting the same stereotypes of female characters they'd read all their lives. And by not reading broadly and reading by women writers, they weren't breaking out of it. So your writing becomes better when you read broadly, especially, even if you only read fantasy, if you read books by people who are different from you to open up your way of seeing and understanding people.
That's awesome. And I love that full inclusion. Even the book that I was reading of yours yesterday included trans characters and other queer characters in there and making sure that they have that representation within your book. How important is that to you in your writing?
It's very important to me. It's also something I'm careful about because I don't want to, as a cis heterosexual woman, mm-hmm. and by the way, some listeners will be so offended by my even saying those words, and I am aware of that, and I'm sensitive to that. But I am a cisgender woman and I am heterosexual. And so if I am writing from the point of view of a marginalized community as though I'm speaking for them, that is a very sensitive thing. So I am very careful. I traditionally do not write from the point of view of the main character, mm-hmm. who's not someone who's more from my certain demographics, because I don't want to speak for anybody. And I also hire and pay, or my publisher does, or both, readers, authenticity readers who are from those communities that can make sure I'm not making some huge errors. But there are a lot of people in this world.
Yeah.
And if, you know, I would say 15 to 20% of the people who I know and are close to are LGBTQ and 0% of the right of the characters I write are LGBTQ, then I am erasing reality.
Right.
And so for me, it's just more about a story is better if there is that, especially when we're talking about fantasy, when you're having like fantastical elements, you need to root it in reality. Mm-hmm. And for me, the reality is always in the humanity, in the characters, in the relationships. That's what feels real when you've got extraordinary things happening. So for me, it's just about, this is what the world looks like. It's not really, for me, it's not an agenda or a soapbox. It's just like, the world is really cool and interesting, and I don't want to erase people. But it does take more time and more care and thought than just writing what you know.
Yeah, and intention, right? Yes. Yeah, no, that's beautiful. That's awesome. I know, Brandon, one of your favorite things to write is dialogue from the point of view of a dragon or a demon, right?
Tell me, you get an authenticity reader from the dragons to do that, Brandon?
Tell me your thought. I remember years ago we talked about, I think it was like the dragon in Wizard of Earthsea, and and just being able to speak from that point of view where you've got a character that's supposed to have, you know, thousands of years of wisdom, and all of a sudden that wisdom's being funneled through a 40-year-old dude, you know, writing in his basement or whatever. Talk to me about writing characters from that point of view.
Yeah, to me, that's one of the funnest things I get to do as I write fantasy, is to try to like, where you really get to truly engage your imagination and say, what does a 6,000-year-old demon on his deathbed sound like? Right. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, like there, and in some ways it's incredibly freeing because there are no issues with appropriation.
No one can prove you wrong.
for a 6,000-year-old demon. Yeah. There's just in your gut, does this feel like it could be this, you know? And like, does this have like a weird air of authenticity to it, or like believability? And I'm always looking for that. And I don't know if I always pull it off, but I love it when I see it. You know what I mean? I love it when it, like, when I read Tolkien's Gandalf, when he speaks like a wizard, to me, I'm like, yeah, I believe that guy's a wizard. I believe it. He captured something where I believe it in his dialogue that he's a wizard. And so like the challenge of, yeah, can I make a satyr believably a satyr? Can I make a dragon believably a dragon? I mean, there's probably not much more that I like more than that. Like right now I'm working on a novel in the Fablehaven universe from the point of view of Newell and Doran, the satyrs. Mm-hmm. And it's a weird choice, kind of, because I'm taking what had been kind of comic relief and saying, hey, what if they were the main characters of maybe a shorter novel, right? And man, it's fun. It's just really fun because it's almost all living in a head that only exists in an imaginary world. You know, like there is no satyr, no good. I mean, like maybe a superficial frat boy, you know, gets close to what I imagine a satyr as. But these guys, they're trying to avoid work. They're reluctant heroes. They want someone else to be the hero, and yet they've had enough in Fablehaven. When you interact with mortals, that is how eternal beings change a little bit. Like some of that more. Like the
mortals change the immortals.
Yeah, in Fablehaven, like the mortals can get magical powers and certain things sometimes from the magical creatures. But there's a flip thing that happens where the magical creatures get introduced to change as they interact with mortals. And so the nature of Newell and Doran would not have been very interesting to me in their pure satyr state, because I think they would have been too frivolous of characters to write about. But to me, it's very interesting that through the adventures of 10 books where we followed Kendra and Seth, they've gone from being frivolous to kind of caring. And so having a novel where they're kind of trying to come to terms with their adolescence kind of ending and them starting to care and feel like adult urges, like and kind of hating it.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
Kind of be like, hey, we used to sleep.
Meaning responsibility and goal setting?
Those urges? I think those are the urges he's talking about.
Yeah, when I say adult urges, I mean like responsibility. Yeah.
Okay, I'm just curious.
Yeah. The things that we don't actually urge.
Yeah. Yeah, but like, for them, it's weird, right? For them, it's hard. For them, like, they're like, we remember when we used to sleep in a little depression in the ground, and that was awesome. And now we have to worry about taking care of a house, but we like the house because we can watch TV and that's frivolous, but it also comes with strings attached, yeah. right? And so like just the thought of these characters growing up and then getting in a situation where they have to be heroes, where they really, like, they're not side characters, like, they're stuck being heroes. To me, that was really fun.
Is that going to be a new series or just a one-off book?
The plan right now is I'm writing it like a one-off book.
Yeah.
And if I get more ideas, maybe I'll write another one. You know what I mean? Like, the door is ajar for maybe doing more, but...
It seems like a perfect end for the series would for them to become accountants or something like that.
Just
like
yeah, it just becomes less and less magical until there's, like, nothing, like, no spark of life in it anymore. Just with dead eyes, they look up from their calculators.
typing. And
amazing.
Yeah.
Shannon, what about for you writing from the point of view of a fantasy character or something?
Yeah.
Tell me about your experience with that.
Oh, I love it. Dean and I, just yesterday, we were doing a couple more books with DC, and we were brainstorming. And I had to just stop because my daughter came in to ask a question. And I said, we were just talking about portals between worlds and what was it? It was some ridiculous scenario. How many Wonder Women is too many Wonder Women to come to? How much of the cosmoclitic event does it have to be to have two Wonder Women show up? You know, and just like the physics of like portals between worlds shutting and what would happen when they were going back and forth. And I had to stop and go, this is our job.
Yeah, we're working right now.
Yes. And because you do kind of get used to, you know, doing this stuff. And then you do want to bring back that childlike wonder of like, I get to just do this and I get paid for it. But even if I didn't, I would be doing it. It is really fun. Dean loves, we always are kind of arguing when we co-write who gets to write like the villain monologues because they are so fun to write those extreme over the top ridiculousness of it. And you do want to feel like, yeah, this sounds like a 600-year-old demon or a satyr and stuff. But what's also fun about it is that twist of the unexpected. Like, I'm not just writing a stereotypical creature. I'm also like, what do I think is something you don't know about a satyr?
Yeah.
That I can add it that you're going to buy. It's not going to be so over the top that you're not going to believe it. You're going to believe it, but you're going to be like, I did not think how enchanted they would be with television. And like, that's a fun twist.
Yeah. Well, and that's in a way, that's the whole thing. Cause how do you bring a human character to life? Their idiosyncrasies,
right.
the little strange human details. And so as you take these magical creatures and give them some unexpected idiosyncrasies, they're suddenly much more real. You know, they suddenly feel much more fleshed out.
Yeah. Let's talk about romance within fantasy novels. How much romance do you guys put in your books? How important is romance within the fantasy genre?
I don't just write fantasy. My first published book was a fantasy, but I've written in just for every age group and just
all over the place,
just about every genre. So at the same time that I was writing my first book, which was a young adult fantasy, I was also writing a romantic comedy and a graphic novel. So from the very beginning, I've always done a lot of different kinds of stuff. I would say in the beginning, I almost always had a romance in any novel I was writing. And the more I lived and the more children I had and everything, I started to veer away from romance as being the central relationship to all the other kinds of relationships that there are. Just because I love romance, and I still write romance. I'm currently writing another romantic comedy. But there's so many great relationships. And what I actually believe now is that we read for relationships.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we care about in stories. Like, I've heard people say that it's characters, but I don't think it is characters. I think it's relationships between characters. That's what we end up caring about. In Hunger Games, how much would we cared about Peeta if we didn't know he was in love with Katniss?
Right.
And suddenly the relationship between them, the uncertainty of it, and his wish, this desire for closeness with this person, whatever that looked like, is why we care about his character and why we're worried about him.
And I think there's a lot of truth there because it even mirrors in life.
Yes,
right?
And that's what's most important in life is relationships.
Right, right.
So like
who you are is cool, but who you care about is even more interesting. And you know, sometimes do you care about me?
There are very few people who are entirely happy, entirely alone.
Right.
Right.
I'm sure they exist, but maybe there's like some kind of relationship with their own self.
But by nature, you don't know them.
That's right. How do we know? That's right. So we care about relationships with people. Everything we kind of doing in life is to make ourselves more comfortable, to make ourselves feel a certain way, and to strengthen whatever relationships we have. And we sometimes make those choices very badly, but that is really the basic human desire.
Yeah.
And so focusing on
So it makes sense that would translate into books, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And romance being a chief one, because it's not just the falling in love part, although that's very exciting emotionally, just like fear is exciting emotionally, like you're going to die is an emotion that people like immediately get hooked into. And falling in love is an emotion that people immediately get hooked into. So it is a device for an emotion that you can use, but also a desire just to be known by someone, mm-hmm. to be seen and loved by someone who sees you completely, whether that's romance, whether that's you know, parent-child, whether that's best friend, whatever, a sibling. It's really playing with different kinds of relationships is for me the most rewarding part of writing.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, if I was going to, I do this, when I break down what I think are the fundamentals of fiction, to me, I break it down with characters, relationships, trouble, decisions, consequences. Those to me, those are the big five things that I think hard about. And I think the whole idea of how do you put life in a story is the characters and the relationships, right? And then how do you make them care about the story? Well, introduce some trouble, make the characters make tough decisions and deal with tough consequences, and bam, you've got a story, right? Like, I like that because it's basic enough that it fits almost everything, you know? But if you're not thinking hard about that, whether you're writing fantasy or whether you're writing anything, like, what are you going to have for a human to care about, right?
We've talked in the past about kind of your spiritual side and a little bit. What how does that influence your fiction writing and your fantasy genre?
Look, like the most important part of my life by far is the spiritual side of my life. It's the part that is most interesting to me. It's the part that I think deepest about and most about. That doesn't disclude my relationships. Or disclude? Is that a word? Disclude, yeah. It's going to be a new word. But like, to me, the spiritual side, like, to me, we're a dual-natured being. We're physical mm-hmm. and spiritual, like we just are. And because I think that, and because it's how I experience life, I experience my relationships that way. I experience everything that way. I think about things in terms of my loved ones who passed on. I don't think of them as gone. I think of them as existing in a spiritual state. And that's a relationship I expect to maintain and have again. And so because that's a big part of my life, it filters into my worldview and it filters into my characters and it filters in. And I may never write a book explicitly about the spiritual, but it is present in almost everything I write. And especially because I'm writing fantasy, I can filter in aspects of my spiritual. When I say my spiritual beliefs, I really don't mean my religion, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Because like I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and I'm happy to be in. I like that religion. But my spiritual beliefs aren't the same as that religion. Like, my spiritual beliefs are what I really think is going on. And in my life, my religion is a component of that. But my religion doesn't try to explain what's really going on in so many ways. You know what I mean? It gives me a snapshot of what's going on. And so I live my life trying to figure out what is actually going on spiritually as a human being. And I try my best to put little nuggets that I've found or seem true to me. I put little nuggets of that into my work because it's a way I can share it without being preachy. You know what I mean? I can have a fantasy scenario where there's a little bit of contemplation of what might be beyond this life. I've had fantasy books where I made fantasy versions of the afterlife that characters interact with. And to me, that's a fun way to speculate and imagine about a component of life that sometimes people don't want to talk about. Like, sometimes it's hard for people to talk about spirituality because it becomes, well, my team thinks this and your team thinks that. It becomes about religion. But I think a lot of people believe in some kind of spiritual component to life, whether they call it the universe or whether they call it self-care or whether they call it, but there's something inside of them that they want to be healthy, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of hard to name. And to me, I name it as your spiritual side is what you're trying to make healthy. And so, yeah, because that's a big part of what I think about, it bleeds into all my work and probably never more than one of my big new series I have coming will have a spiritual component to the story that is exciting to me as part of the reason I like the project.
Awesome. Have you told us the name of that series yet on the podcast? I don't remember. Or is it still kind of
I think it's
under
still
wraps?
Sort of under wraps. Okay. So I won't fully say it yet.
That's a beautiful tease.
Yeah.
Just FYI, Game of Thrones is taken.
Yeah.
So don't.
Don't do Game of Thrones. Yeah. Huh?
But Goose Girls.
Goose Girls, plural, has not been used.
Goose Guys.
Goose Guys.
How did we not think of this earlier?
They all wear sunglasses.
They're so cool.
Yeah.
Shannon, do you have any thoughts on the spiritual side? And does that bleed into your writing at all? Or?
Yes, I am not a religious person. I am not believing or participating in any kind of organized religion. But I am, so there's something I think about a lot is a writer, Eckhart Tolle. He talks about us all being human beings, and there's the human side of us and there's the being side of us. And the human side being our bodies, our history, our form self, all the things we identify with, our experiences. And the being side being a timeless aspect of ourselves that is constantly connected with every other being, whether, you know, trees or planets or God, if we use that word, or anything else, and that's a source of constant peace and joy. And when we're tapped into that aspect of ourselves and present with that aspect of ourselves, then the human side goes better than when we block it out. And that is something that I just on a daily, minute-by-minute basis am always, even as I'm just sitting here several times, I've just stopped and, you know, taken some breaths and kind of connected with that deeper self in myself, because I say, I can just speak better when I'm there. The great irony for me is that I didn't know what I was doing all those years, but I always did that when I was writing. I didn't have words for it. I didn't have a metaphor for it, because really it's a metaphor. Everything we're talking about, you can't really put words to, because it's experiences. What amazes me is I can look back, I'm sure this happens with you, Mol, where you write something, and then at a later draft, you figure something out and you realize you already planted seeds for that in an earlier draft. And you're like, I didn't even know that about that character yet, but somehow I'd set it up in this scene. There is these sort of little miracle wonder things that happen when you're writing. Someone once explained it as though your book is already written and you are going through a process of trying to channel it out from wherever it is and recreate it.
That's very similar to like the Michelangelo sculptor thing. Like there's
yes, a, it's in that block
it's
somewhere.
It's in that block somewhere, and you have to pull it out.
Yes.
Know? Stephen King talks about it that way too, where he says he feels like he's like an archaeologist excavating his story, like removing the stuff that's in the way so he can find what's actually there. Mm.
And the story is smarter than I am. Like always, everything I've ever written, like I know I couldn't have thought up on myself. There are things that I've discovered later in life as like being beautiful pearls of wisdom. And I realized that like, oh, I actually said that like several books ago, but yeah. I didn't really know what I was saying yet.
Right.
So there's something that happens, I think, not just with writing, but I think when we talk about creativity, I think what it really is tapping into that being part of ourselves.
Yeah.
And I don't have firm beliefs about what that means, what that looks like, or afterlife, or anything else. And I feel so comfortable with everyone having whatever beliefs they have, because I don't think in terms of one truth and some I'm right and you're wrong. I just, my brain doesn't work that way. And so I'm really happy later in my life to let go of that, because it never felt right to me. But I do think when we talk about creativity, we're tapping into our deeper selves. We're tapping into that well of connection and like peace and joy and love, or whatever words we have that are inadequate. God, universe, whatever they are. And whether we're drawing, we're singing, we're dancing, we're, you know, be creatively accounting, you know, that's when we really get in touch with those things. And why I mourn for the kind of sidelining of the arts in school, as though the only thing that really matters are things that are going to make you money, because the being part of us, if we call it the spiritual side, that's where joy comes from, and satisfaction and contentment and the peace in the world and everything. So, and the arts help us learn how to draw from that. And I think that's as important or more than how we're going to make a living.
Yeah. And often leads to making a living.
Surprisingly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you trust that self, when you can trust your deeper self, it's like the universe is going to take care of you.
Interesting doors open up.
Yes.
I to use different language for the same thing, I've noticed there's a flow state for a lot of activities, right? And we can equate that to a flow state when you're skiing, right. or a flow state when you're driving. And when you're in a flow state where you're just kind of really present and you're just kind of living it and you're really in the moment and you just do a little better than if you overthought it, than if you were overthinking it. And I think about this because never more than in writing, if I can get lost in sort of a flow state, that's not too far from the reader's trance of kind of a flow state when you're reading, right? When you're just experiencing the story instead
of, a good way of putting it.
The tree was, you know. When you're writing and you're in a flow state, I'm strongly convinced that you're tapping into something more than yourself.
Yes.
And that all sorts of things might come through when you're in that state. That someday you might look back and feel smarter than you were because it wasn't you.
It wasn't, or it was truly you.
You were. And
without
you,
all the.
I like that. I think
a deeper level of you than maybe was conscious at the time, right?
Yeah. And then that deeper level of you that's connected to everything else. So what's smarter than everything?
Right, right.
It's beautiful. And it's. I love that we get to do that. One of the things that you're talking about, this writer Eckhart Tolle talks about, is that being present in the present moment is the only place of power, because there is no future and there's no past. What we call the past were previous present moments, and there is no future, because when we get there, it's the present moment. And the cause of depression is like trying to, you know,
live in the past.
Live in the past, and anxiety is trying to live in the future. And there are certain activities that force us into the present moment. You talk about skiing, sometimes like hard exercise can pull you into the present moment. Sometimes people are like near death experience, like sometimes people like come back from war and they miss something about it, because when you're in those streaming environments, you're forced into the present moment.
They were so present and therefore so alive.
So alive.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so, and there's a peace in it, unlike anything else.
Right.
And when I'm writing, when I'm in the flow, there's nowhere else I can be but the present moment. And the more I can bring that into my everyday life, not just when I'm creating, that's currently like my hour by hour spiritual practice.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean,
we just got real deep, man. We're talking about fantasy.
We got very deep, but that's the thing. I think fantasy, it taps into these very primal things.
Yeah.
It taps into these,
absolutely.
And gosh, any form of creation does, right? But as we create fantasy, maybe in some ways, especially because it's so outside of our experience, we have to tap into something else to get there. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a beautiful place to end this. So thank you both for being here and to Mull It Over with Brandon Mull.
Hey there, fellow adventurers. I am Jason Conforto.
And I'm Tyler Crump, and we are hosts of a podcast, Adventure AI, where we play Dungeons & Dragons with an AI named Alex the Language Lord.
I'm Alex the Language Lord. Join us as we craft epic tales together.
Do you want to learn how to use AI in your D&D campaign?
Or how AI can force you to do things that you don't want to do? Wait a second, we don't like that.
Look no further. Adventure AI is the podcast for all your AI-powered D&D adventures.
Alex the Language Lord not only comes up with campaigns for us,
he also helps us create our characters, create our backstories, and even give us some fun magical items.
And really takes all of the human aspects out of Dungeons & Dragons. So it's not really playing at all.
Follow Adventure AI on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.